THE EVERLASTING MAN by G.K. Chesterton. Chapter 5 of Book 2. THE ESCAPE FROM PAGANISM. The modern missionary, with his palm-leaf hat and his umbrella, has become rather a figure of fun. He is chaffed among men of the world for the ease with which he can be eaten by cannibals, and the narrow bigotry which makes him regard the cannibal culture as lower than his own. Perhaps the best part of the joke is that the men of the world do not see that the joke is against themselves. It is rather ridiculous to ask a man just about to be boiled in a pot and eaten at a purely religious feast why he does not regard all religions as equally friendly and fraternal. But there is a more subtle criticism uttered against the more old-fashioned missionary, to the effect that he generalizes too broadly about the heathen, and pays too little attention to the difference between Muhammad and Mumbo-Jumbo. There was probably truth in this complaint, especially in the past. But it is my main contention here that the exaggeration is all the other way at present. It is the temptation of the professors to treat mythologies too much as theologies, as things thoroughly thought out are seriously held. It is the temptation of the intellectuals to take much too seriously the fine shades of various schools in the rather irresponsible metaphysics of Asia. Above all, it is their temptation to miss the real truth implied in the idea of Aquinas contra Gentiles, or Athanasius contra Mundum. If the missionary says, in fact, that he is exceptional in being a Christian, and that the rest of the races and religions can be collectively classified as heathen, he is perfectly right. He may say it in quite the wrong spirit, in which case he is spiritually wrong. But in the cold light of philosophy and history, he is intellectually right. He may not be right-minded, but he is right. He may not even have a right to be right, but he is right. The outer world to which he brings his creed really is something subject to certain generalizations covering all its varieties, and is not merely a variety of similar creeds. Perhaps it is, in any case, too much a temptation to pride or hypocrisy to call it heathenry. Perhaps it could be better simply to call it humanity. But there are certain broad characteristics of what we call humanity, while it remains in what we call heathenry. They are not necessarily bad characteristics. Some of them are worthy of the respect of Christendom. Some of them have been absorbed and transfigured in the substance of Christendom. But they existed before Christendom, and they still exist outside of Christendom, as certainly as the sea existed before a boat, and all round a boat. And they have as strong and as universal and as unmistakable a savor as the sea. For instance, all real scholars who have studied the Greek and Roman culture say one thing about it. They agree that in the ancient world, religion was one thing and philosophy quite another. There was very little effort to rationalize and at the same time to realize a real belief in the gods. There was very little pretense of any such real belief among the philosophers. But neither had the passion, or perhaps the power, to persecute the other, save in particular and peculiar cases. And neither the philosopher in his school, nor the priest in his temple, seems ever to have seriously contemplated his own concept as covering the world. A priest sacrificing to Artemis in Calydon did not seem to think that people would some day sacrifice to her instead of to Isis beyond the sea. A sage, following the vegetarian rule of the Neopythagoreans, did not seem to think it would universally prevail, and exclude the methods of Epictetus or Epicurus. We may call this liberality if we like. I am not dealing with an argument, but describing an atmosphere. All this, I say, is admitted by all scholars, but what neither the learned nor the unlearned have fully realized, perhaps, is that this description is really an exact description of all non-Christian civilization today, and especially of the great civilizations of the East. Eastern paganism really is much more all of a piece, just as ancient paganism was much more all of a piece than the modern critics admit. It is a many-colored Persian carpet, as the other was a varied and tessellated Roman pavement. But the one real crack right across that pavement came from the earthquake of the crucifixion. The modern European, seeking his religion in Asia, is reading his religion into Asia. Religion there is something different. It is both more and less. He is like a man mapping out the sea as land, marking waves as mountains, not understanding the nature of its peculiar permanence. It is perfectly true that Asia has its own dignity and poetry and high civilization. But it is not in the least true that Asia has its own definite dominions of moral government, where all loyalty is conceived in terms of morality, as when we say that Ireland is Catholic, or that New England was Puritan. The map is not marked out in religions, in our sense of churches. The state of mind is far more subtle, more relative, more secretive, more varied and changing, like the colors of the snake. The Moslem is the nearest approach to a militant Christian, and that is precisely because he is a much nearer approach to an envoy from Western civilization. The Moslem, in the heart of Asia, almost stands for the soul of Europe. And as he stands between them and Europe in the matter of space, so he stands between them and Christianity in the matter of time. In that sense, the Moslems in Asia are merely like the Nestorians in Asia. Islam, historically speaking, is the greatest of the Eastern heresies. It owed something to the quite isolated and unique individuality of Israel, but it owed more to Byzantium and the theological enthusiasm of Christendom. It owed something even to the Crusades. It owed nothing whatever to Asia. It owed nothing to the atmosphere of the ancient and traditional world of Asia, with its immemorial etiquette and its bottomless or bewildering philosophies. All that ancient and actual Asia felt the entrance of Islam as something foreign and Western and warlike, piercing it like a spear. Even where we might trace in dotted lines the domains of Asian religions, we should probably be reading into them something dogmatical and ethical belonging to our own religion. It is as if a European, ignorant of the American atmosphere, were to suppose that each state was a separate and sovereign state as patriotic as France or Poland. Or that when a Yankee referred fondly to his hometown, he meant that he had no other nation, like a citizen of ancient Athens or Rome. As he would be reading a certain particular sort of loyalty into America, so we are reading a particular sort of loyalty into Asia. There are loyalties of other kinds, but not what men in the West mean by being a believer, by trying to be a Christian, by being a good Protestant or a practicing Catholic. In the intellectual world, it means something far more vague and varied by doubts and speculations. In the moral world, it means something far more loose and drifting. A professor of Persian at one of our great universities, so passionate a partisan of the East as practically to profess a contempt for the West, said to a friend of mine, "You will never understand Oriental religions, because you always conceive religion as connected to ethics. This kind really has nothing to do with ethics." We have most of us known some masters of the higher wisdom, some pilgrims upon the path to power, some Eastern esoteric saints and seers, who had really nothing to do with ethics. Something different, something detached and irresponsible, tinges the moral atmosphere of Asia, and touches even that of Islam. It was very realistically caught in the atmosphere of Hassan, and a very horrible atmosphere, too. It is even more vivid in such glimpses as we get of the genuine and ancient cults of Asia. Deeper than the depths of metaphysics, far down in the abysses of mystical meditations, under all that solemn universe of spiritual things, is a secret, an intangible and a terrible levity. It does not really very much matter what one does, either because they do not believe in a devil, or because they do believe in a destiny, or because experience here is everything and eternal life something totally different. But for some reason they are totally different. I have read somewhere that there were three great friends famous in medieval Persia for their unity of mind. One became the responsible and respected vizier of the great king. The second was the poet Omar, pessimist and Epicurean, drinking wine in mockery of Muhammad. The third was the old man of the mountain, who maddened his people with hashish, that they might murder each other people with daggers. It does not really much matter what one does. The Sultan in Hassan would have understood all those three men. Indeed, he was all those three men. But this sort of universalist cannot have what we call a character. It is what we call a chaos. He cannot choose, he cannot fight, he cannot repent, he cannot hope. He is not in the same sense creating something, for creation means rejection. He is not, in our religious phrase, making his soul. For our doctrine of salvation does really mean a labor like that of a man trying to make a statue beautiful, of victory with wings. For that, there must be a final choice, for a man cannot make statues without rejecting stone. And there really is this ultimate unmorality behind the metaphysics of Asia. And the reason is that there has been nothing through all those unthinkable ages to bring the human mind sharply to the point, to tell it that the time has come to choose. The mind has lived too much in eternity. The soul has been too immortal, in the special sense that it ignores the idea of mortal sin. It has had too much of eternity, in the sense that it has not had enough of the hour of death and the day of judgment. It is not crucial enough, in the literal sense that it has not had enough of the cross. But that is what we mean when we say that Asia is very old. But strictly speaking, Europe is quite as old as Asia. Indeed, in a sense, any place is as old as any other place. What we mean is that Europe has not merely gone on growing older. It has been born again. Asia is all humanity, as it has worked out its human doom. Asia, in its vast territory and in its varied populations, in its heights of past achievement and its depths of dark speculation, is itself a world, and represents something of what we mean when we speak of the world. It is a cosmos rather than a continent. It is the world as man has made it, and contains many of the most wonderful things that man has made. Therefore, Asia stands as the one representative of paganism and the one rival to Christendom. But everywhere else, where we get glimpses of that mortal destiny, they suggest stages in the same story, where Asia trails away into the southern archipelagos of the savages, or where a darkness full of nameless shapes dwells in the heart of Africa, or where the last survivors of lost races linger in the cold volcano of prehistoric America. It is all the same story. Sometimes, perhaps, later chapters of the same story. It is men entangled in the forest of their own mythology. It is men drowned in the sea of their own metaphysics. Polytheists have grown weary of the wildest of fictions. Monotheists have grown weary of the most wonderful of truths. Diabolists here and there have such a hatred of heaven and earth that they have tried to take refuge in hell. It is the fall of man, and it is exactly that fall that was being felt by our own fathers at the first moment of the Roman decline. We also were going down that side road, down that easy slope, following the magnificent procession of the high civilizations of the world. If the Church had not entered the world then, it seems probable that Europe would be now very much what Asia is now. Something may be allowed for a real difference of race and environment, visible in the ancient as in the modern world. But after all, we talk about the changeless East very largely because it has not suffered the great change. Paganism in its last phase showed considerable signs of becoming equally changeless. This would mean that new schools or sects of philosophy would not arise, as new schools did arise in antiquity and do arise in Asia. It does not mean that there would be no real mystics or visionaries, as there were mystics in antiquity and are mystics in Asia. It does not mean that there would be no social codes, as there were codes in antiquity and are codes in Asia. It does not mean that there could not be good men or happy lives, for God has given all men a conscience, and conscience can give all men a kind of peace. But it does mean that the tone and proportion of all these things, and especially the proportion of good and evil things, would be in the unchanged West what they are in the changeless East. And nobody who looks at that changeless East honestly and with a real sympathy can believe that there is anything there remotely resembling the challenge and revolution of the faith. In short, if classical paganism had lingered until now, a number of things might well have lingered with it, and they would look very like what we call the religions of the East. There would still be Pythagoreans teaching reincarnation, as there are still Hindus teaching reincarnation. There would still be Stoics making a religion out of reason and virtue, as there are still Confucians making a religion out of reason and virtue. There would still be Neoplatonists studying transcendental truths, the meaning of which was mysterious to other people, and disputed even amongst themselves. As the Buddhists still study a transcendentalism, mysterious to others and disputed among themselves. There would still be intelligent Apollonians, apparently worshipping the sun god, but explaining that they were worshipping the divine principle, just as there are still intelligent Parsis, apparently worshipping the sun, but explaining that they are worshipping the deity. There would still be wild Dionysians dancing on the mountain, as there are still wild dervishes dancing in the desert. There would still be crowds of people attending the popular feasts of the gods, in pagan Europe as in pagan Asia. There would still be crowds of gods, local and other, for them to worship. And there would still be a great many more people who worshipped them than people who believed in them. Finally, there would still be a very large number of people who did worship gods and did believe in gods, and who believed in gods and worshipped gods simply because they were demons. There would still be Levantines secretly sacrificing to Moloch, as there are still thugs secretly sacrificing to Kali. There would still be a great deal of magic, and a great deal of it would be black magic. There would still be a considerable admiration of Seneca and a considerable imitation of Nero. Just as the exalted epigrams of Confucius could coexist with the tortures of China. And over all that tangled forest of traditions, growing wild or withering, would brood the broad silence of a singular and even nameless mood. But the nearest name of it is nothing. All these things, good and bad, would have an indescribable air of being too old to die. None of these things occupying Europe, in the absence of Christendom, would bear the least likeness to Christendom, since the Pythagorean metempsychosis would still be there. We might call it the Pythagorean religion, as we talk about the Buddhist religion. As the noble maxims of Socrates would still be there, we might call it the Socratic religion, as we talk about the Confucian religion. As the popular holiday was still marked by a mythological hymn to Adonis, we might call it the religion of Adonis, as we talk about the religion of Juggernaut. As literature would still be based on the Greek mythology, we might call that mythology a religion, as we call the Hindu mythology a religion. We might say that there were so many thousands or millions of people belonging to that religion, in the sense of frequenting such temples or merely living in a land full of such temples. But if we called the last tradition of Pythagoras or the lingering legend of Adonis by the name of a religion, then we must find some other name for the Church of Christ. If anybody says that philosophic maxims presented through many ages, or mythological temples frequented by many people, are things of the same class and category as the Church, it is enough to answer, quite simply, that they are not. Nobody thinks they are the same when he sees them in the old civilization of Greece and Rome. Nobody would think they were the same if that civilization had lasted 2,000 years longer and existed at the present day. Nobody can, in reason, think they are the same in the parallel pagan civilization in the East as it is at the present day. None of these philosophies or mythologies are anything like a church, certainly nothing like a church militant. And as I have shown elsewhere, even if this rule were not already proved, the exception would prove the rule. The rule is that pre-Christian or pagan history does not produce a church militant, and the exception or what some would call the exception, is that Islam is at least militant if it is not church. And that is precisely because Islam is the one religious rival that is not pre-Christian, and therefore not, in that sense, pagan. Islam was a product of Christianity, even if it was a byproduct, even if it was a bad product. It was no more surprising. It was a heresy, or a parody, emulating and therefore imitating the church. It is no more surprising that Mohammedanism had something of her fighting spirit than that Quakerism had something of her peaceful spirit. After Christianity, there are any number of such emulations or extensions. Before it, there are none. The church militant is thus unique because it is an army marching to effect a universal deliverance. The bondage from which the world is thus to be delivered is something that is very well symbolized by the state of Asia, as by the state of pagan Europe. I do not mean merely their moral or immoral state. The missionary, as a matter of fact, has much more to say for himself than the enlightened imagine, even when he says that the heathen are idolatrous and immoral. A touch or two of realistic experience about Eastern religion, even about Moslem religion, will reveal some startling insensibilities in ethics, such as the practical indifference to the line between passion and perversion. It is not prejudice, but practical experience, that says that Asia is full of demons as well as gods. But the evil I mean is in the mind, and it is in the mind whenever the mind has worked for a long time alone. It is what happens when all dreaming and thinking have come to an end in an emptiness that is at once negation and necessity. It sounds like an anarchy, but it is also a slavery. It is what has been called already the Wheel of Asia. All those recurrent arguments about cause and effect, or things beginning and ending in the mind, which make it impossible for the soul really to strike out and go anywhere or do anything. And the point is that it is not necessarily peculiar to Asiatics. It would have been true in the end of Europeans, if something had not happened. If the church militant had not been a thing marching, all men would have been marking time. If the church militant had not endured a discipline, all men would have endured a slavery. End of Part 1 of Chapter 5 of Book 2 of The Everlasting Man.